Good morning, everyone. I really wanted to say I appreciated the invite, and also I love that this is a multi-generational space. Good morning. Seeing the children being read to that Julian is a mermaid is an awesome, radical thing because, as you know, Julian presents as a boy in the story, and it's really the writer wanted to talk about how boy things are not just for boys, right? And girl things are not just for girls. And also at our workshop yesterday, we discussed white people's obsession with the Little Mermaid being white and how there's a black actress that Disney is now casting to be the Little Mermaid and how wonderfully non-racist white people all of a sudden are talking about race. So I love my job. I'm going to be talking to you all about direct reparations, and some of you may not know what that means, and I invite you to participate in the conversation by first listening to what it is I'm here to present to you, and then going to do your research on your own. Many of us have cellular phones and libraries, and we are in a privileged space that you use, right, and that you can Google the information after the service. I need y'all to think back. Think all the way back. Some of you need to think further than others. To your first job. And I don't necessarily mean your first place of employment. I mean the first gig you ever did to get paid. Could be shoveling snow, babysitting, drug dealing, or perhaps it was a regular job. Who knows? Would anyone like to share their first paid gig? Babysitting, Nandi?
I sang at a wedding.
You sang at a wedding? You got paid? Okay, get your $50, girl. For many of you, has anyone else had a different job that wasn't traditional?
Braiding hair.
Braiding hair, okay. Who's, okay, Esther, okay. All right. So do y'all remember what it felt like the first few times you got paid for a hard day's work? I remember my first paying gig. I was a paper person at the Patriot Ledger, which was a newspaper company in Randolph, Massachusetts. And on payday, you couldn't tell me nothing with my $123. I thought I was the shit. It felt good, that feeling of independence, of freedom. I don't know exactly what it was, and still to this day I can't name it, but I know it felt good. And you youths are notoriously known for wanting to feel good. Now, as you get older, the novelty wears off, right? And the bills pile on. But those first few paid gigs, they just hit differently. Now, does anybody remember the first time they ever lost real money? Just raise your hand. Real money. I mean, I don't mean spend it. I mean you literally cashed your check and then you lost it. I'll never forget the first time this happened to me. I worked a summer job in my sophomore year of high school. As soon as I got my working papers, I was at Brigham's Ice Cream Parlor. One of my first checks I cashed, I remember I had to go to the check cashing place with my mom because I didn't have a bank account. And I put the money in my pockets, and it must have fallen out on the way home. I went wild looking for that money. I retraced my steps a half a dozen times, and my mother was like, "Haven't you already been outside three times today?" I kept checking the same pockets over and over again. That was me for a whole weekend. I don't even remember how much it was, but in my mind, it may as well have been $1 million. I got physically sick because in my house, money was often scarce, and losing money was an unspeakable sin. I didn't want to tell her, but eventually I fessed up to my mom. She was upset too, but she said something that I still remember to this day. She said, "I bet whoever found it needed the charity." Okay, so two things. One, that did not make me feel better. Because up until that point, I still thought I was going to find the money. But two, it also marks me realizing I also didn't like the word charity. I started getting upset at this imaginary person who stole my hard-earned cash. This charity case that no doubt stalked me from the check cashing place waiting for my pathetic summer check to fall out of my pocket so they could bounce on it to buy lobster and caviar. Isn't that what y'all say about food stamp recipients? I look back on that time now, and I think about how much capitalism played a role in my feelings at that moment. I was ashamed for losing money because I knew my family was poor. And I was ashamed at the idea of someone who, quote, didn't deserve it, finding my hard-earned cash. So I don't know if it's irony or growth that today, direct giving and resource redistribution are the majority of my work. The shame is gone, and in a weird way, I've even embraced, or at least accepted, poverty because it's where I'm at. So although I'd started using my new platform in a way that I hoped would help others, my advocacy, I've noticed, had become performative. And performative means I started out with good intentions, but there was no actual result. I would just share people's GoFundMe and no one would click on it, right? There was no benefit aside from the fact that I was gaining more social capital for being a good ally to trans folks, to disabled folks, to single mothers, for bringing up these issues. So I started experimenting a little bit with the asks that I would put out to see how I could go from performative allyship to more substantiated results. And in doing so, I realized that white people are completely clueless. So I'd ask people to pay reparations. Sometimes I'd get inboxes to my messenger that said, "How much should I pay?" Or asking for easier ways for them to pay. Sometimes people would inbox me telling me I paid, or asking if they're sure did the payment go through. Sometimes people would ask me, could I send them a receipt? I couldn't tell if people wanted my approval or were just clueless as how to proceed with these pretty straightforward asks. So I started changing the way I'd ask white people to pay reparations. I'm going to give you an example. Is that okay? The following black femme is in dire need of groceries to sustain her and her three children. Please donate $10 to this PayPal account. If you do not have PayPal, please use this Venmo account instead. And after you have completed the payment, please write "done" in the comments so I can keep track of who has paid. Then brush your teeth, turn out all the lights, and then go to sleep. My posts became so specific that I felt like I was being condescending, which I thought I was. But it worked. I think another thing that white people struggle with is how do we remove inequity? How do we remove the double standards that constantly threaten the lives of black folks? How do we remove the colored-only white fountain that still stands in place today without the sign? That's the question. And you know white people. When black people ask questions, white people like to ask clarifying questions. Especially when it's something that doesn't affect them, like, oh my God, do we need a permit first? Don't we need a certified plumber? We don't want to damage the building in the process. Can't we just reform these whites-only fountains? No, we can't. And I think that that's why there's a lot of tension in our country right now. We've ignored our greatest sins for so long. We've let this inequity build and exist while we talk about how to handle it. I found out this morning it took y'all quite some time to put up that Black Lives Matter sign. We may even offer more symbolic gestures here and there, and a few of our issues may get somewhat resolved, but ultimately, I've decided we haven't taken the steps to dismantle the root cause of what this tension is. I've spent years of my life experiencing oppression as a woman and non-gendered person at times, as a black person, as someone who is queer and also is cash poor and living with a disability. Most recently, my oppression has been built in being a single mother, and I've spent most of my time trying to figure out how to change things and make a better life for myself despite my oppression. In doing this forced research, I've come up with some things that need to be understood socially if we ever hope to truly dismantle systemic white oppression and white supremacy. How many of you follow me on social media? Oh, so little. Get better, white people. For those of you who do follow me on social media, you would know that I've built a platform on redirecting funds, often in the form of reparations, from men and white folks to black women and non-men. I have the same gift that Joel Osteen has. Except instead of getting rich off of my work, I managed to stay just poor enough to keep it going. And I like to think that I come from a long line of hustlers turned freedom fighters who found a way to use their skills to help protect marginalized people. But protect them from what? As I mentioned before, capitalism is a source of shame that is the driving force for most of the oppression I see around me. So I see capitalism as the enemy. And direct giving is a way of subverting and destabilizing capitalism. By the way, the flip side of direct giving is direct taking, but I'm going to save that for another keynote speech. But anyways, today I'd like to talk to you about the three aspects of direct giving, and then I added a fourth one because I was just really, really motivated yesterday by my workshop. I'd like to talk to you about the three aspects of direct giving that I think are often overlooked in the discussion about reparations. How many of you believe that the government owes reparations to Black folks? Thank you. How many of you are holding your government accountable? Thank you. Okay. The first thing I want to speak about, I've already touched on a little bit, and that's direct giving as a form of resistance. Can y'all say that with me? Direct giving as a form of resistance. When I think of some of the most radical and revolutionary acts of resistance, they can often be tied to direct giving. I'll give you an example. Take the Underground Railroad. How many people knew that Vermont was the first state to abolish slavery? Doesn't matter. We know that, though, right? To be honest, I actually didn't know that until recently. But what I did know is that Vermont is famous for the role it played in the Underground Railroad, a secret path used by enslaved people coming north from the south, walking towards freedom. When we think about direct giving, it's not just Cash App and PayPal. We're talking about any resources of value. And giving someone safe passage and a roof to sleep under while you escape oppression definitely counts. And Vermont became a major destination along the railroad largely because of its reputation for resisting slavery. Today, we see this happening again as people try to protect undocumented immigrants from ICE raids and deportation. We have to be prepared to offer these types of protections if we are serious about protecting those in harm's way. But even when we're talking about cash reparations, we're providing marginalized people with the tools to escape and/or fight oppression. I'm not sure why folks aren't making the connection, because that too is also resistance. Recently, I organized an anti-white supremacy protest in Boston, don't know if you heard of it, where 40,000 people attended. One of the first things we did was to fundraise money to post bail in the event that any of our people were imprisoned by the Boston police. 33 people were arrested, and we were able to successfully bail them all out. In addition to bail funds, we were able to provide transportation, childcare, and housing for organizers on the ground that came from all over the world to assist us hold this march. We used a relatively small amount of funds to mobilize an army of protesters. That's resistance. And direct giving is actually what facilitated it. We raised $60,000 in 3 days. There's a reason why banks are making it harder and harder to transfer funds, and it don't have shit to do with Al-Qaeda. Every day, there's a new rule or restriction on PayPal that I have found we have to work around. I am currently banned from using Cash App, and I never once used reparations to harm anyone. The powers that be want to slow down and stop direct giving because they know it's a threat to the status quo. They know it's an act of resistance, and we should know it too while doing this work. I remember that on my trip to Cuba, PayPal had frozen my PayPal account because people were telling me to have a fun time in Cuba in the note section. It's important to focus on building our communities and giving directly to those that are local to us. But what happens when you live in a community where there are so very few Black folks that are local to you? The hardest type of direct giving is to suppress that. It's not reliant on the internet or banks. It depends entirely on you and your network. There's a quote by a friend of mine, Laura Lamoon, that goes, "An ally should be personally gaining nothing through their activism. In fact, if you are an ally, you should be losing things through your activism. You should be losing space, your voice, recognition, the validation you think you deserve, identity, and your ego. I love this quote when it's applied to direct giving because it contrasts with our current models of charity. When you donate to a charity, your ego comes right along with it. I give to the Red Cross. And that's the second aspect I want to discuss today. Direct giving for spiritual instead of social gain. Direct giving for spiritual instead of social gain. When you look at nonprofits, they currently benefit immensely from their version of charity. And I think about the ways that nonprofits exploit the systems. I currently work for a small nonprofit, I won't name it, but I make minimum wage in the state of New York, while my CEO, who I'm the executive assistant to, makes four times the amount of what I make. Any money that comes additionally into our company has to go to programs. And instead of discussing admin salaries, right? Admin is actually the lowest paid team members. Instead of discussing admin salaries so we can help sustain the rest of the programming, we just create new programs. So what does that do? It doesn't make the company bigger, actually. It doesn't make us deliver more. It just stresses out the workload of the admin team. But that's the nature of nonprofits, and that's why you've hopefully heard of things like the nonprofit industrialization complex, right? It's the same thing as the nonprofit and the privatization of prisons. One thing I've noticed when doing this work is that direct giving, even when done ethically and selflessly, still results in a personal gain of some sort. Whether it's social capital or a massive platform or just making us feel good about ourselves, I used to find that I was at odds with Laura's quote. But now I understand that we can still gain nothing from our activism if we're balancing the checkbook, so to speak. We just have to get back down to zero if we find ourselves gaining more than we're giving. And that means we have to offset the personal gains. The less privilege you have, the easier this is to do, since we're already starting from a deficit if you're a Black person in this room. But for people of higher privilege, this requires an ongoing and continuous effort. If you start to work with Black folks or Indigenous folks, you start to work with education reform, and people are rewarding you for your work, you need to take a step back and start again at the bottom. This is what I mean by resetting your checkbook. Because the work should not be elevating you as an individual, it should be elevating the marginalized communities that you're fighting for. It requires some self-awareness and some self-control as well. And direct giving with your money, since we get so caught up in the ego and the accolades, is the easiest way to do that. Because after your money leaves, you know, we talked about this yesterday, you're not asking the Red Cross to provide you with a report, although they can, and they probably will, and it's probably fudged. You're not looking for it after you donate your $25. It's okay to find this kind of work spiritually rewarding. Because that's the type of reward that benefits everyone. You ever been around someone and their spirit just gave you life? You were like, yes, I like you as a person. Want to hang out with you again. Would you like to go out for coffee? You use love going out for coffee. Why? Because a good spirit is contagious. Embrace that. Let that energy take the place of privileges we taught ourselves to cling to. And do it without keeping track of what got you there. I've noticed that white people especially love to keep score. They love receipts of their good deeds because deep down they're still trying to prove that they're one of the good ones. I'm here to tell you today to please let that go. It's not serving you in your spiritual walk. Pretend that every day you wake up, you're starting over to combat white supremacy. I don't care how far along you are on the woke train. Look at Tina Fey. She said yes. The slate is never going to be clean. It's dirty because you still benefit from it every day that you wake up. This isn't about making yourself feel bad for being white. It's about acknowledging the privileges that come with being white and finding a way to reallocate them. And lastly, when you reallocate them, do so in a way that doesn't have strings attached, which brings me to my next point. Direct giving without the respectability politics. I'm agnostic atheist, sort of like straddling the fence, but I know something about the Bible. Does anybody know what Jesus' first miracle was? Say it. Yes, it was making wine out of water. Before he healed any lepers or walked on the water, he got all his people drunk at a wedding. Talk about direct giving. But still, today, a common trope of charity is the image of giving a homeless man food because of some fear he just spent his money on the wine. That's nonsense. Jesus knew it was nonsense, and that's why he gave everybody wine. And Dee Dee knows it's nonsense, and you know it's nonsense too. The golden rule for giving is that you should prioritize the most marginalized. What they decide to do with those resources isn't our concern. It's not about us. My last point will be direct giving of space by removing the requirement of respectability and niceness. In an article I penned for The Establishment, which Ijeoma Oluo was a co-editor for, I said, today we have a myriad of predominantly white-led racial justice groups to choose from, with memberships booming thanks to frantic constituents still in shock with the 2016 latest political regime change. That's a recipe for disaster. And I've personally observed problematic behavior, lack of accountability, and outright anti-blackness from predominantly white-led groups like Resource Generation, White People Challenging Racism, Surge, Anti-Racism Collaborative, Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration, the Unitarian Universalist Churches, and its association, the UUA, just to name a few. And if you think I'm talking about an outside person, I've worked intimately with all of these organizations as I used to be the program coordinator for Multicultural Growth and Witness at the UUA in Boston for 2 years. After seeing a tweet from CBS News stating, quote, Amber Guyer, who killed Botham Jean, breaks down in tears while testifying in her defense at her murder trial. Quote, I wish he was the one that took the gun and killed me. I never wanted to take an innocent person's life. I am so sorry. Activist and Teen Vogue contributor Laura Witt commented, white women weaponize their tears to elicit sympathy from audiences after they've perpetrated harm against black and brown people. Beatrice King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s youngest child, posted a photo of black folks dressed in three-piece suits and dresses and wrote, please never use my father to suggest or assert that respectability can cure racism. The white supremacy-affirming racist discriminates against black bodies, whether the bodies are in sharp suits or in sagging pants. Lastly, my father was assassinated while dressed respectably. I'm asking you to consider the ways in which respectability, niceness, and civility, which white colonizers brought to not only this indigenous land, but to many others, consider the ways that your requirement to engage in civil discourse removes the space that black and indigenous folks earn to take up because they're so angry with your ancestors and the way that you still benefit from them today. After co-learning from the participants in my workshop yesterday about the amazing work being done here in Vermont with the migrant community in the state, I challenge you also, listen closely, to not forget that your sign that y'all spent 2 years deciding to put up says that Black Lives Matter and that systemic racism continues to keep Black communities here in Vermont small and struggling to flourish. Consider the multiple ways you can engage with people you do not know and people who are having a hard time here. Several people voiced concerns, and then we had a dinner yesterday, that people are of color might want to move out of Vermont if they haven't been here for generations, because it's so hard being the constant reminder that blackness exists. I constantly sense the frustration within myself and among my circles about white people's unwillingness to share their space, their time, and as I read on the UU website yesterday, their treasure. I didn't even know that was a word that y'all use, your treasure. I once wrote a status that read, are you overwhelmed with the sheer number of people who need help right now? Don't be. Give what you can and help where you can. Be generous. Budget your time and your resources so that you're not over or underextending yourself. Please encourage others to do the same by caring and realizing the importance of wealth redistribution. keep focusing on the most marginalized. It's not your job to save everybody. It's our collective job to make sure that everyone is taken care of, though. We will win. And you know what? I didn't believe a word of that shit when I wrote it. I was just bored. But it's one of the most shared posts on my Facebook page. And sometimes I believe it now. I do believe that one person does make a difference. I need to believe this, and I know other people need to hear it too. And just know that before we leave here today, that we walk on the road that has been forged by generations of tireless freedom fighters. We walk in the same trails as Mama Tubman and Sojourner Truth. We are sitting here in the same seats as Claudette Colvin and Rosa Parks. We have to continue to uplift and echo the same words as Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. Those are some pretty big shoes to fill. And our success isn't going to be measured in how quickly we can fill those shoes or how big our ego helps to dress up the rest of the outfit, but in how long we're willing to keep those shoes on. Thank you.